Welcome to the Entertainment Engine.
Welcome to the Entertainment Engine podcast. I'm Pete Moore.
And I'm Bex Gregory. This podcast was created by our company, Seamless Entertainment. We're providing in-depth advice and information for creatives pursuing a career in the entertainment industry.
It's a great passion of ours, and we're looking forward to sharing our knowledge with you all.
Each week, we'll be bringing our listeners some great entertainment facts and news, mixed in with special guest interviews from seasoned professionals who share their insight and experience of the business.
You can listen and subscribe to the podcast on all streaming platforms so you never miss an episode. And what a bonus, it's totally free.
Plus, please stick around to the end of this episode, because we are going to be playing a trailer from a new podcast series that we think you'll find really interesting. It's a participatory arts podcast that launched this month, which subtly invites listeners to a hidden world existing all around you. In each episode, there are challenges and small collaborative acts you can participate in the real world. Will you choose the instructions within? Visit signal.com. That's spelled SYGNYL.com. So check it out and remember to stick around to the end where we will be playing a little clip for you. So stay tuned. And now it's time for part two of the conversation with Lionel Lodge.
And this really leads us on to, Lionel, I want to dig into about Sync Lodge, about what you started, how this came about. I know it's a big area from you, so it'd be great to learn more about where you're at with Sync Lodge, what you're getting up to, and how can we all learn more, really?
Well, okay, great. I'd love to talk about it. It's my main thing. I wake up thinking about it. I go to sleep thinking about it. It's in my dreams, right? This is my wife is very, very. I'm very fortunate to be with her because she just lets me work, yeah. Right? And 7 days a week, I've been doing this. And we started in 2017 working on this, October 2017, and we're about to release it. And what it is I looked at the sync licensing industry and with the fail of CDs and the lack of income from streaming for artists, sync licensing became a real focus, right? You get a placement and it's good money. And if you can get advertising, it's really good money. You could support a band for a year and a couple albums out of an advertisement, right?
Yeah.
And so this is was something, but I also realized how fractured and confused the industry was and how there's a lot of unnecessary competition. And there is also the center of the industry are people called music supervisors, and they work for the film company, the producer or director, or the visual production company, and they choose the music. They get a brief and are told, okay, we're looking for this scene, we're looking for this sort of thing. And they go out and they try to find it, and they give suggestions to them. And they also find out if they're under this budget and these terms, if they can use the music from the copyright holders. And the music supervisors are underpaid. Okay, they're one of the least paid in the whole process, right? And they didn't have any tools to work with. And it's the 21st century, and they didn't have, you know, they're using Google Docs, using Excel files, they're using Word documents and emails, and they're, you know, all these disjointed elements to try to work on something that's very complicated and stressful, and they usually don't have a lot of time to finish it, and a lot of them are working on between 10 to 15. We did surveys, and most were doing 10 to 15 projects at a time.
Wow.
But there was quite a few that were doing over 30 projects at a time, right? And these are creative people. These are very nice people that have, you know, they're trying to support their family doing this, right? And it's a huge amount of work and all that. So what we've done is we built the tools for the music supervisors, right? A full set of tools. And people who've shown it to us have told us it's a fundamental step forward for the industry. You know, incredibly impressive, incredibly useful. Right, and this is from people in the industry have said this. So we built them all these tools to actually do from the beginning of the project right to finalization, automated many of the steps in it, many of the tedious things we've automated. And then we've also have a portal for the copyright holders. And copyright holders can come on, and it's all free. Right? For the music supervisors, there's visual production company portal, and there's a copyright holders portal, and it's all free to use. Our business model is we ask for 2% of the license. So when the placement goes through and the artist gets paid or the record company gets paid, we ask for only 2% of that, which is not heard of in the industry, right? Most are lowest here is 20 to 25. Mostly they're like 50%, and they're also on the back end, right? So they're on the broadcast royalties as well. We don't touch the broadcast royalties. We don't touch any of that. So our thinking is, let's support the music supervisors, and let's support the independent artists. Let's give them, let's level the playing field. So if your music is good and it's suitable for this TV show or this film, and they search for it and you're on our system, they will find it. And it doesn't matter if you're at Universal or if you're, you know, living in Hawaii or if you're living in Spain or if you're living wherever you're living in the world, it doesn't matter. And your level of fame or your plays on Spotify, that doesn't matter either, right? If your music is suitable, they will find it and they will consider it. And this is the whole basic gist of it. You know, let's build a system, an ecosystem that the industry as a community can work together.
Yeah, I agree. And I think just done a couple of podcasts, actually one gone out today about the streaming side of it, of how, you know, like Spotify are not making any money, but they're building a corporate brand. And, you know, music is a byproduct. And now they're looking at podcasts. You know, and you sort of think, hang on a minute. Yeah. You know, no artists are getting paid any money. It is all still the 1%. And, you know, I gave a breakdown of, I think I did sort of like 50,000 streams gets you like $250, and a quarter of a million gets you $1,660. Yeah. I think it might have been on Deezer or somebody like that.
Yeah.
I'm like, so anything like this that you're doing, Lion, I think is got to be good for the indies. And the 2% is, like you said, it's non-heard of, because most of it could be non-exclusive and it's a 50-50 deal.
But we don't represent the catalogs, right? Like, it's totally a system where the artist still owns everything. They come on, they become a member for free, they upload their catalog information, right? All their metadata, right? Descriptive and ownership metadata. And then it's there. And through systems, we can access it. Like, if they have it on Spotify, if they have it on Apple, or if they're using other, there's other companies that we're hooking up to, right? There's dozens of them we're hooking the system up to that actually house the audio. We don't house the audio.
Yeah.
And so we link it up so that the music supervisor can hear it, and it's there. And we're building also a whole community forum so people can communicate. You can put notices of releases, and music supervisors can put notices of briefs, looking for music, right? We're looking for this, and people can respond to that. And the idea is, okay, why do we need to make, it's a big industry, there's a lot going on, the only way to bring it together is to remove all barriers of entry, right?
Correct.
Like, so no reason, if you own a copyright on a song, you're sitting in your bedroom, you've written 10 songs, and you got out on Spotify, you wanna be a member of Sync Lodge, have your music there, and if it's suitable, then they will get in touch with you.
Exactly, And I mean, what, have you had any resistance with the platform at the moment? What's sort of been the feedback for the industry at the moment?
Well, no. So on the music supervisor side, everybody we've talked to, the guilds in both the UK and in the US, and also music supervisors in Mexico and Australia and in many different countries. And everybody on the music supervisor side love it. Excellent. I've shown it to them how it works. They're great, excellent, wonderful. Wow. When can we start using it? On the copyright holder's side, all the independents have had the same reaction. This is great, excellent, where can I get on it? Yeah. The majors, the only major that gave us a bit of sort of, not sure, was Sony ATV. And they said, well, we're the biggest publishing company in the world, so why do we need you? So I said, okay, I'll tell you why you need us, because there's over 20,000 music supervisors globally, and you're not reaching them. And if they find your music on Spotify, they don't know how to get in touch with you.
No.
Right? And also, if they do get in touch with you, they don't know how to ask you, what information they need to send you for you to consider whether or not you're going to license this. Our system makes it so the first communication is all the information you need to consider that. And the guy at Sony ATV said, well, that's interesting, because I just finished a placement that took over 40 communications back and forth to get all the information clear.
There you go.
Yeah. There you go. You know, we'll see. They want to see it working. They want to see the music supervisors using it. And we're confident that they will come in. But the other thing I've said to the majors is, Okay, so the independent industry, part of the industry, is over 40% of the music right now.
Yeah.
And it's growing faster than the majors are.
Yeah.
Right? So if a music supervisor is looking for a specific type of music, are you telling me they can only find it in at your catalog? I don't think so. I think they'll find it in independents for sure. And then you guys are missing out.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Right? If you don't play with us, you're going to be missing out. And of course, the independents have it. And of course, the independents are a lot easier to deal with.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think you've touched on a really good point, actually, Lionel, because some of my experience has been working with some, you know, really good music supervisors and understanding their landscape. They all sort of worked, I think, what is it, Sony and BMG. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they found were when you worked at a major label and you're pitching, you know, for TV and film, sometimes it can be quite lazy. So the artist will come in and say, oh, you know, did you pitch that for, you know, XYZ movie? Oh, well, we didn't get round to it. Oh, we didn't get round to it. So what I've seen happen with some supervisor that we know in LA and New York is that some of the major acts are pulling their material from that label to play, to go to the independents and say, well, we'll put it with the independent. We know we're still with the major publisher, but the indies can work a lot more quicker and a lot more nimble in what they do. And if they're going to bring an opportunity to us, we're not going to turn the money down.
Yeah, and they're hungry. They're hungry for
hungry
it.
For it,
and it's a big excitement. It's not like I placed three things in advertisements this week, and it adds up to £750,000.
Yeah,
That's my day, my week's work done.
Oh, blah, exactly, we'll see exactly. That. Oh yeah, how many? I'd love to turn around to say that we just done a placement for $750,000, but we haven't.
Yeah.
So
yeah, or even, you know, an independent, if they get $50,000 for something, they're out partying that night and popping champagne. Woo-hee! We got, you know, this is great.
Exactly.
Right? That sort of energy also the music supervisors really like. That's one of the key things, right? They like finding those and having that effect on these independent record companies or publishers and their artists, and knowing they're having a big effect on their world is a really great feeling for them.
Yeah. Well, I think I can, one of the things I was talking to, because Becky was having a look at your site, and there's just many artists we can go to, and I think they'd be coming to you with open arms to say, here's our music, here's one album, or here's, you know, 10 tracks. I mean, we've got some of the producers we work with in the States. He'd probably send me over 100 tracks tomorrow to say, can you upload these into the system? So I think a lot of content's great. And that's what we've also found as well, Lionel, that each month we're going to be showcasing a different artist from around the world, what's called the Entertainment Spotlight. So we will showcase an artist, play their track, do a bit of intro with them, give out their website and what they're doing, and give them a shout. But from out of that, we're going to suggest to the artist that we'll do our own playlist, we'll do our own compilation album, and then with all the artists that we're working with, it's just a natural progression to come to you and say, well, they just want to drop all their music into you. And
why not?
And they're going to say to me, so what's your percentage? And I say, well, we'll just do a deal with you. If you get a deal, we'll have a little slice of the cake. But to be honest with you, we're not going to, no one's going to be ripping you off. So I think it benefits everybody.
Yeah, very good, very good. And the other side of the system is it's also like it's a platform online, but it's also a desktop application, the full thing.
Okay.
And the cool thing for copyright holders is that then you can actually manage your catalog inside it. So you can manage all your metadata, you can manage all your descriptive metadata, you can manage your full catalog as a desktop application inside this system. And then when you want to publish it to the platform, you can.
Right. Wow.
So you have a new release coming up, you know, a new album or a new artist, and you can start putting all the information in. You can put all the and work on it, how it describes it, and whatever you want to put into there. And then when it's on the release day, you can hit one button, publishes it to our site.
Wow. So effectively, an artist could come in and upload their album, their two albums, and then if that music supervisor is looking for that, say, that particular genre of music, say, just say it's pop, for example, would those albums be related to pop and have like keywords based on the pop element of nice?
Yeah. Some descriptive metadata. Having the mood, the tempo, the genre of voice, instrumentation. We have quite a list of fields for descriptive metadata. And we suggest that people put as much as they can in, right? As much as they feel is appropriate. But the one key of that is not to overdo it. I saw one artist that just put, you know, they went from A to Z. Of all the types of descriptive, which doesn't do them any favors at all.
No, no.
It backfires totally.
No.
But we also have a system for auto metadata tagging.
Okay.
And this is through a third party company. Okay. And it's very reasonably priced. I think it's really cheap. And you put your music into their system, and it through AI, it fills in all the descriptive metadata for you.
Oh wow!
And and it's a very good system. We've tested 6 different systems globally that do that. And this is a company called Cyanite out of Berlin.
Okay.
And they're the truest of the truths.
Wow.
It's the best way to put it, because you know, it's all subjective, my opinion compared to your opinion, right? But they really have a great system. And so it makes it a lot easier. So you don't have to spend days typing in, what is this song about? And how do I describe this one, right? It'll just go through, and it's a matter of seconds, and you got all your metadata.
Oh, wow. How did the idea come about initially? Was it on your travels?
Because my CD sales were going down, and it was suggested to be where I was one point in California, and a friend of my dad's who's a big music industry attorney in California, he said, "Have you ever thought of sync licensing?" And I said, "What's that?" And obviously, when he pointed it out, I said, "Well, of course, right? Music and film and videos of art, but I'd never considered, I'd never put the two together, right?"
No.
This is in the early 2000s. And so I started doing it for myself. And then, like my other businesses, I was doing okay. And other artists came to me and said, "Will you do it for us?" And so then I built up, and I had this boutique agency for sync licensing. And I was going to conferences, and I was meeting music supervisors, and I was making friends and seeing how the industry works. And we were doing okay. And then it hit me one day. I was watching, I was at one conference, and there's they call them futurists. And basically they look at industries and tell what's going to be happening in the next 5 to 10 years.
Right? Yeah.
And there's this Swiss guy named Gerda Leonhardt. And, he was at this conference, and he was talking about how this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and these parts of the industry are going to become redundant. And I went back. It was a little depressing. I went back came back home, and I looked it up on YouTube, and he had done it for also the auto industry, for the telecom industry. He had gone around the world doing all these, studying their industries. And I'm there sitting at my computer with another artist giving me stuff, and I'm typing in all this stuff, and I'm working, and I'm typing. And it just hit me that everything I'm doing is going to become redundant, right? Right, there's got to be a better way of doing this. And I stood out. I really like standing out in my backyard and just looking at the stars and just running through thoughts. And I did this, and the whole thing of Sync Lodge came to me. This is how it should work. This is what the industry needs. I thought, somebody's got to do this. I just got to find them. Somebody's already done this, obviously. It's so simple. It seems so obvious. And I spent a good number of weeks looking for it and never found it.
Right.
And so then I thought, okay, I got to do it. I'm going to do this. And then I put together the team. We have all the developments in-house. I have great partners. We finance the whole thing ourselves. There's no outside financing.
No.
And we, you know, we're almost there. It's taken a lot of work. And the money that's gone into it is a good sized house on a nice bit of property with a couple car garage and a swimming pool in the backyard. That's basically what it's cost.
Yeah, it's a big chunk of change, as they say.
Yeah, but it's well worth it. It's well worth it, and we're almost there with releasing it. We're hoping to be able to, in near the end of February, to be able to do the private beta launch.
Okay.
And what we're doing with this is we have, I think it's 17 key music supervisors that are going to be using it and testing it, and giving us weekly Zoom conference feedback.
Yeah.
Right? We've had a lot of feedback all right through, so we're hoping they're not going to suggest too many major things. Right?
Because, those things before they get, exactly.
Yeah. And during that time, we're going to be, before the private beta launch, we're going to be inviting copyright holders to register and have their music available for this private beta testing. So if people go on synclodge.com, and that's our landing page. They'll see that to sign up is not working yet. You can't register or sign up. But if they scroll down about a third of the page, they'll see for the different types of users, there's visual production companies, music supervisors, and copyright holders. They can sign up to be notified on launch.
Okay.
And this, we just ask a few little bits of information. It just takes a couple seconds. And then we will contact the copyright holders before we launch and invite them to come in and put their catalog on the system for the private beta testing. And then we think that will take about 3 to 4 weeks, and then we'll launch it fully.
Wow. That's exciting. you know. That,
yeah,
that,
yeah, it is.
That is exciting because I think I wouldn't say the doors were closed, but where you've got the big labels and the big conglomerates, where it is only really for the few, I think where synchronization and film and TV's opened up, and you know, we work quite heavily in the film side, and you know, I'm a big fan of finding that song, placing it into that movie, and even if you're turning on, you know, Netflix or Amazon or whatever you might be watching, Lionel, you still see that song and you think, wow, where did that song come from? And suddenly it's everywhere. It's on an advert, it's on YouTube, wherever.
It can change a band's or an artist's career, right, big time. And even you know, just the financial rewards from that, you know, the broadcast royalties. If it's on television and it's in the States and it's getting played regularly and it's on a commercial, the broadcast royalties are huge, right?
Yeah.
And one of the barriers for independence, for music supervisors to use independence that they don't know, is verification of information. How do I know that this person is really the owner of this? How do I really, how can I trust this? Because if they're lying to me in any way and we put it on the thing and it comes back, I'm going to lose my job. The music supervisor will lose their job. They won't work with that production company again, right? And this is something that they're very worried about, of trusting unknowns.
Yes.
And so our system, actually, it verifies, it checks for all the publishing copyright holder information with the PROs and the CMOs. Automatically, the music supervisors click a button, they put in the song title and the feature artist name, so like the band name, song title, and it checks through all these databases and finds the information. And then there's also a verification system. There are other systems that are just for verifying these databases, and it looks for any discrepancies. And if there are discrepancies, it lets the music supervisor know, this is the, you know, the original database had three publishers, this one has four. This is the name of the fourth publisher. This is how I get in touch with them. And it also lets the copyright holder know there's a discrepancy. This database is either you're wrong or they're wrong. You got to go to them and fix it.
Yeah.
And this gives for, you know, we verify every member that comes into the site, we verify who they are. And then they get a verification badge on who they actually are. And then also with the verification on ownership. And music supervisors have said, this is so cool. Because now I can actually use bands. If I've never dealt with them before, but I like their music, I can actually feel confident on actually using their music.
Yeah. Well, I think that just opens up for the independent sector to say that you've been verified, everything's all good. Now you've got a shot just as much as anybody.
That's right. That's right. And why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they, right?
Well, why not? I mean, you've hit on a really interesting point and a real valid point as well, Lionel, because I think that is one biggest thing that we've come across, especially if you've got a movie, it's $1 million or it's 100 million, you've got a trust element. And some of the people we've worked with, that, you know, they move with the speed of trust. And I quite like that analogy because it's actually very, very true. And I think music supervisors are under such a lot of pressure to deliver the music. And sometimes I think from the other side of it, the producers and directors do not understand what it takes to clear that music. And they come in and say, well, we've only got a budget for $10 now, when really you've got to have a budget for $1.5 million to do what you need to do. And I think there's a lot, not great clarity in that area. So I think the music supervisor has to battle with all of that. And then the producer will come at the end of the project and say, oh yeah, we've got to do the end credit now, but we've only got 20 quid. You're like, you can't do that. You can't
That's
do that.
Right. That's right. And it's also the other side is where the music supervisor puts up, say, 10 songs for a spot. And they've found all the copyright holders, right? They've talked to them all and say, they've all said, yes, we will agree on that price for that usage. Yes, we will agree on that. They've done all this work, right? And it's just days of work. And they take it to the producer or the showrunner. And the person goes, I don't like any of that. Find me something else. Right? Well, it's part of the business, and they do accept that is part of the business, right? And this is, or scenes get cut, or scenes get added right at the last minute, right? And this sort of thing. And so the idea that within a few clicks they can actually have all that information and they can verify it, right? And with a few clicks they can send out the quote request to the artists or the copyright holders and say, you know, would you accept this? This price for this usage, would you accept it? And they can get it right back through the system. Yes, we would. Or they can negotiate a bit if needed. And it speeds up that whole process and makes it so that the also at the end, you know, we've automated so many elements of it that the music supervisors would spend days, tedious office work. Right. And we've automated these elements like the cue sheets and the payment ledgers.
Yeah, and that takes out just a whole lot of unnecessary work that people have to do so they can concentrate on something, you know.
On the creative side.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a creative industry.
Yeah, and that's one of the other things that I think, again, if you look at publishing, you look at the sync world, you look at merchandising, you look at live, they obviously with live at the moment is very difficult, but it will come back, and I'm sure it will come back stronger than ever when it can. But I do think the sync world is very, very exciting, because if you're ironing out those sort of bumps in the road, Lionel, especially with supervisors, mm-hmm. because it's something that I've come across with quite a few of them as well. And there's one that we deal with in Los Angeles, and he's great, but he's so paranoid, is probably not the right word, but he's to the point of, can you really get that song? Can you really clear that song? Or do they actually own that song? So I had to put him on a call with the people, the rights holders for these particular music. And he came away and he went, oh no, I'm happy now.
But that's their job, right? That is their job to worry about that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if they miss that, then they, like I said, they won't work again.
No.
Right? You do a couple of those, especially in a center like LA, your word gets out that you've done that a couple of times, well, you're gone, right?
Exactly.
Forget it, find another job. And the other thing we do is also with the musicians' unions. And they are becoming a bigger player in what they call in the States new usage, and in the UK it's called reusage.
Yep.
And if the recording has musicians' union authority over it, which means that if somebody on the recording, some of the players are a member of the union or is done in a union studio, then the musicians' unions can charge a fee for usage. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that is quite complicated, and a lot of music supervisors are not aware of or how to deal with this. And we're in touch with a lot of the musicians' unions and making it so that flow of information is very easy for the music supervisors. A couple of clicks, they send off the information to the musicians' unions and they get a reply.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing this. I'm going to be telling artists about it as well. So
get them to go on the landing page and sign up to be notified.
I will.
The best way. And if anybody wants, you know, if people want a walkthrough, it's obviously easier for me if there's a small group than one-on-ones, but I'm also okay with one-on-ones. You know, you can reach out to me and just reach out to me and we can schedule something. And I'm very happy to show it.
Well, I'll talk to Bex about it. I'm sure she will. And I should talk to Alan about it as well. And I think it'll be quite a few other people. So yeah, I will certainly, because I think it's a good thing. Definitely. I think anything great, that can help things. The indie sector and just move forward, I think is a good thing, to be honest with you.
Our quote, our sort of working phrase is pulling together so we all move forward.
Well, no, I all power to your elbow, I think. It's really, really cool. And I suppose it really leads me on to as well, Lionel, with really what you're doing with Sing Lodge and with all your experience over the many years, what's been your best resources that helped you through the music industry? What's the one thing that sort of, or a couple of things that have helped you along the way?
Blind faith, right? There's that song about the ant.
Once
there was a silly old ant, thought it could move a rubber tree plant, right?
Right.
That sort of attitude of getting excited by doing something. And sometimes it's been a business project, sometimes it's been an album, sometimes it's been a song or a tour. You know, like the first time I went to Ukraine, or the first time I played through different parts of Europe. This is the sort of thing. Okay, let's do that. Let's figure out how to do that. And the excitement about it, and thinking, okay, and understanding that there's going to be obstacles. There's going to be things that are going to get in our way. There's an old philosophy on obstacles, and they say that right before the biggest success is the biggest obstacle.
Yeah.
That's when most people give up.
True. Yeah.
Which is incredibly frustrating, because you think this obstacle we're dealing with is the biggest one. And after that is going to be the success. But then you realize, no, that was just a medium-sized one. This is not a bigger one coming.
Yeah. and they just get bigger and bigger, and you just got to keep knocking down.
And you keep thinking, okay, yeah, as soon as we get through this one, it's going to work, right?
Yeah.
But there was also, what was that? There was that the plane, this is back, I think, in the 70s, that crashed in some Northern America, North Canada or someplace, and they crashed in some mountains somewhere. And it was a true story. And they turned into cannibalism because they starving.
Yes.
Right? They started eating the dead people.
Yes.
Right? They didn't kill people to eat them, but the people that died, they started eating them. And they went on expeditions to try to find someplace. And they never did that. They never found it. But if they'd gone in the other direction, it was like not that far away. There was a camp. There was some sort of village there. Right? And they didn't know about it. It was just right within reach of them.
Hindsight is great, isn't
it? yeah, that's right. So sometimes when I'm hitting an obstacle, I think, okay, am I looking at this in the wrong way? Am I going in the wrong direction?
So what would you got a young artist in front of you today, and they're looking to pursue a career in the industry, what would be your advice to them today?
Okay, well, if they want to, you know, on the business side, I would say study it. And there's a lot of resources like your podcast, right? The way they can actually study it and take it seriously to study it. And but if it's on the creative side, you know, I would obviously on an instrument, listen to the way other people play and not to copy them, but to think about what you really like about it. Some if you're a guitar player, there's a guitar player that really turns you on. Why does that turn you on? Why does that excite you? And not just to copy the licks he's playing, but get inside why that excites you and bring it over to your own side. You know, there's the guitar player in the Pixies, and I saw them a little over a year ago in Vienna.
Yeah.
And Joey Santiago, I think his name is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love his playing. And I stood there and watched him, and the way he used his right hand, the aggression of it, the energy of it, I just thought, okay, that's that sound. That's what he's doing. Oh my God, there it is right there. Right? And that sort of thing, you know. I also have coached people on singing, and I've told them, okay, if you really want to be a good singer, look at the way Whitney Houston sings. Look at the way she uses her mouth. Don't copy her singing, but just look how the way she uses it, right? Understand the tools that you have and how to use them better, to use them in the way that what the direction where you want to be. How do I get there? And I've got all these tools. How do I use them to get there?
And I think the more we look at, you know, that type of advice and you sort of glee from what people are saying, I think it just makes you a better artist or better person. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're more aware human being. Right. Ultimately, that's at the end of the day, that's what it is. Right. We're here. We're born. We live. We die. And the in between part is the learning.
Exactly.
The experience of it. Right.
Exactly.
This is how do I change? How do I grow? And but one more thing for lyricists. And I do get this quite a bit from lyricists of how to become a better lyricist. And I tell people, don't start listening to pop records. You know, nothing against listening to pop records, right? But don't take your inspiration from there. Read great books, right?
Yeah.
Read classics, read really great writers and how they use words. Understand that, you know? And all the listening audience were how they would rate Bruce Springsteen or Dylan in their writing, but that's what those guys did. They read the classics, they read great books, and they understood how the emotion, how using words makes for emotional shifts.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's learning your craft, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think you made a really good point really early on in our conversation with, you know, with Keith Richards, and we'd just go on stage and he just play because he thoroughly enjoys it. And I think if you do that, then anything can happen, Lionel. If you're looking at the big ticket at the end of the day, it doesn't tend to happen. So just be good at what you do and thoroughly enjoy it. And people will pick up on that for sure.
Yeah, it's infectious. It's totally infectious, right? And Keith Richards is a good example on both sides, because he also sat and listened over and over again to blues records. And learned how what are they doing? How do they get that groove? How do they get that feel? You know, it's not just learning the notes, it's the feel of it. How do I get that as a inside my guts to understand that?
Yeah.
So then anything I play, I can play that with. Right?
Yeah. And I think that's when, again, that resonates back to the audience, because the audience then goes to a festival or an intimate concert and they leave that event on a high because they just experienced a great show, and they will talk about that particular song or that particular guitarist or that drummer, mm-hmm. and it leaves mm-hmm. them on a, well, that was, I can't get enough, I've got to go and buy the album,
yeah,
or I've got to get the t-shirt or whatever. And I think that's where music is such a powerful thing, really.
Yeah, it's that human energy, you know, and there's a whole thing of, if you're up on stage and you're, you know, Bruce Springsteen once said this, and it's very true, about him and Steve Van Zandt on stage playing, and their rule was, if you're thinking about it, you're not doing it, right? You're not doing it. You're thinking about it. You got to just get up there and play. So before you get up on stage, make sure you know what you're playing, right? Rehearse it and think about it while you're rehearsing, right? And get it so it's what you want to do. But then when you get up on stage, and there's a huge difference between somebody trying to do something on stage and somebody just doing it. That energy that people feel in the audience, that freedom that they feel, right? That joyous interaction, right? When you see that, it's just, you can't deny it.
Right? No, you can't. And I think Becky and I went to the Isle of Wight a few times, and one of the years we did go, and I'm glad I've got to see him play, was C6 Steve. And John Paul Jones came on with him from Led Zeppelin, and you know, he's just there with his guitar, and John Paul Jones with his bass. But to be honest with you, Lionel, it was phenomenal. It really was that good.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was,
and if
that
John Paul
good.
Jones gets up, he's a great example of somebody that plays because he loves it. Phenomenal player, right? Legendary player. But to get up on stage with just a guitar player and no ego about it, right? No, look, I am a legend. I am, you know, I only play with certain, you know. And I've met people that are on the lower ends that already had that attitude, and it was just bogus. But for John Paul Jones to get up like that, I'm sure his reasons for doing it, the why was really true. And that's why it was great.
And the energy was great. The energy, I mean, I again saw C6 Steve on Jules Holland, and his energy was really great. And coming back to the point that we said many, many times on it, the why, he knew why he was there and what he was doing. And you can tell a true artist, you don't have to be a global artist, you can tell a true artist from not a true artist because of the energy and that they will give and that performance. And you go, I don't care whether it's a global act or whether it's a guy down the pub playing in front of one person. I don't really care. To be honest,
totally agree.
If the music's great and you think, and I'll go and buy the album, or I'll go and check out that particular artist, and I think that's great.
Yeah, I've seen some artists playing. I once did this was a couple of years ago, I did a thing in Vienna where it was last minute, somebody cancelled at a club, and phoned up a friend of mine, and they said, well, maybe you get four songwriters to come in, you guys to rotate as songwriters and do some songs each, and just rotate through. And they asked me if I'd do it. So I go down there, and all of us, there was four of us, and three of us brought side players.
Right? Yeah.
So I brought a couple side players with me, and everybody brought it. And this young woman, she's maybe 22, 23 years old. She shows up all by herself, acoustic guitar on her back, sits in the corner by herself, gets up to do the sound check. And we all just sit there and we're like, oh my God. And she was just so full of fire and passion, right? So, okay, geez, she's all just by herself. And then the show starts, and we start rotating through. And I said to her, well, you should go on as the fourth.
Yeah.
That was a bit of cowardly of me, right?
Yeah.
On as the fourth. But we did, I think we rotated three times through the evening, right?
Yeah.
By the end of it, her last couple songs, we were all playing with her. We were all on stage backing her, right? And she was just, had no worries about what anybody thought of her. She was just full of this fire and just played these original songs that were just beautiful. And it's really spiked songs, spiked lyrics, right? But just honest, right? And she wasn't, you know, she wasn't Aretha Franklin on the vocal. She wasn't, you know, a world-class guitar player. But that didn't matter.
No. Yeah? No. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Lionel, but I think one of the last chats that we had when you was doing your touring and shows, did you open for Alanis Morissette?
Yeah, I opened for Alanis Morissette and a few other bands. Jethro Tull, I opened for them a few times.
Yeah. How did they come about? It'd be great. Yeah, how did those experiences come about?
Okay, there's a good thing. So here, this was actually in Vienna, okay? And every time a band that I liked came to town, I would find out who the promoter was. And obviously the posters go up months before for big bands, right? Months and months before, sometimes a year before. So I'd find out who the promoter was and I'd phone them up, or I'd go and knock on their office door and say, "Hi, I'm Lionel. I'd like to open up for these guys. You're the promoter for this show, right? I'd like to do the opening set. I won't charge you anything. Totally for free." Right? And they said, you know, at first it was, no. We got somebody else. No. We got somebody else, right? And then after a bit, it started happening, right? After a bit, I was just every time that somebody came to town that I liked, that I was a fan of, and I'd ask, right? And at first they'd say, "Let me check on it." And I'd say, "Okay, can I get back to you in a week?" I asked them and make sure that I locked in a time and a day that I could get back to them. "How about, I'll get back to you at 2:00 in the afternoon on Monday, next Monday. How about that?" And the person would go, yeah, okay. Without really thinking about it. And then exactly 2:00, I'd phone the guy back up, or the woman back up, right?
Yeah.
And say, "Hi, it's me. Now, do you have an answer?" "Oh, I don't know yet, right? And then it just started coming through. "Yeah, okay, Lionel. Okay, yeah. Alanis Morissette, sure. Right? Okay, Jethro Tull. Okay, sure. Yeah, we can do that." And the key thing about that was I didn't charge them any money, right? And a lot of bands were saying, "No, okay, it's, you know, there's 10,000 people here, and we're doing the, out of 3 hours, we're doing one of the hours, so we should get paid."
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
No, because I was doing original songs. And I registered it through the performance royalty societies, right? I registered the set list after the show, right? And for Alanis Morissette, I think I got just under 3,000 euro.
Wow.
Right, on my royalties, right?
Yeah.
And the Jethro Tull shows were more than that, right? It was a bigger audience, bigger tickets, right? And the promoter's paying that anyway.
Of course. Right?
He doesn't know. It doesn't matter to him. He's paying on venue size, attendance, and ticket costs, right?
Of course, yeah.
Right? So it doesn't matter to him where it goes. And if I hadn't acclaimed it, Alanis Morissette would have claimed the last 2 hours. My hour wouldn't have been claimed. The PRO would have put it in a black box and given it to Elton John, right?
Exactly.
Right? So it was a great thing. It was a great thing. I built up very nice relationships with different promoters. Right? And I was always friendly about it, right? I wasn't pushy, right? And I didn't try to sell myself. Right? I didn't try to say, "We're great, and I've got great songs, and everybody loves me, and I've got all these people that are going to come down." I didn't say anything like that. I just say, "I'm a big fan. I'd love to do it.
Right? Yeah.
Give me a chance. I'd love to do it." Right? And eventually it started. And when I did the Alanis Morissette was the first one, and we did a whole bunch of different stuff after that. But the promoter, when we went on stage, we were backstage, the lights go down in the house, right? The audience is going crazy. We're not on the bill. Nobody knows that there's an opening act, right? They're expecting Alanis Morissette to come out.
Yeah.
Right? There's these 10 steps up to the stage. The promoter's right there and he's nervous. He looks and he goes, "Okay, I hope you guys," like he's nervous, right? And I said to him, "Are you okay?" He goes, "Well, you know," I said, "Don't you worry about a thing." Because I wasn't nervous, right? I wasn't nervous at all. And I thought, okay, what's the worst that's going to happen here? What's the worst that's going to happen? I'm going to go back to the part where I'm phoning up promoters and they're not giving me shows. That's where I was last week. Okay, so it doesn't matter. I'm going to go up there and have a lot of fun, right? It's going to be great sound. It's going to be, the whole thing's great. So we go up and it's just me and a guitar player. We just go up there. We sit on the stools. And the first thing I say is, "I've got some bad news for you. Sorry, I'm not Alanis Morissette, but she'll be on later." And they loved it. And afterwards, we come back off the stage and the promoter just shook my hand, goes, "That was great. That was really great. We got to talk about some other things."
And there you go. And because of the way you dealt with it and you dealt with yourself and you built trust, there you go. That's a great lesson. That's a great lesson for any young band coming through the industry.
That's right. And, the thing about nerves on stage, right? Like there's a funny philosophy on that. If you're nervous because you're trying to impress, you're trying to do something, right? And my philosophy on that is, okay, practice, know your stuff really well before you get up on stage, right? So you can play it without even thinking about it. But don't try to impress anybody. Don't worry about failing because you will make mistakes. Eric Clapton makes mistakes every time he gets on stage. We just don't notice it. He notices it and it pisses him off, right?
Yeah.
Nobody else notices it, right? Don't worry about mistakes. You know, you're going to make some. Don't worry about that at all. But it's your energy. Right? One time I was opening at a big festival it was the Saturday night. We were the second last band on, and Manfred Mann's Earth Band was the main band on the Saturday night. And before I'm on stage, there's like maybe 20,000 people out front, and I'm waiting to go on. There's some radio guy's going to introduce us, and the guy backstage says, "Are you nervous?" And I looked at him and said, "What do I have to be nervous about?" I said, "They should be nervous. All those people out there, I've got like 45 minutes and a big PA and a microphone. Right? I can do whatever I want. They should be nervous. I'm not nervous."
No, I think it's just, you know, great experiences. And I think, again, with you know, young people and different people listening to the podcast, I think it's just good information for the community and to learn from. And
yeah,
again, if you're going about with a smile on your face and asking the right question and just being courteous about it, I do think lots of things can happen. Even sometimes, if you get a no, you might get a yes the next time. There you go.
Well, you're going to get no's. You're going to get no's, right? You know, this is part of it. Of course you're going to get no's, and just expect the no's and enjoy the process.
Exactly.
And just enjoy it. And if you're not enjoying it, then figure out something else to do.
Exactly. So what would be... what really annoys you about the business, past and present? What's the one thing that gets on your wick about it?
Well, just the lack of transparency in deals, lack of transparency in ownership, the lack of transparency in what people are doing, and the fact that there are people that are in the industry. Now, I would hope it's few, but there are still them there that are looking to take advantage.
Yeah,
they're looking to find a young artist and know the person's naive and sign them up and push them to be big and make all the money, right? And this is an old story. You know, the idea that it's okay, it's business, yes, but you know, Jesus, let's be human beings about it.
Yeah.
Let's realize we're gonna die one day, and am I gonna be proud of that? Okay, I made $10 million off this artist and they ended up being broke and living with their mother.
Yeah.
Right? Am I going to be proud about that on my deathbed? No, I won't, right?
No.
And that is the main thing that pisses me off. That the you know, even on the small scale of small promoters ripping off artists or band leaders not paying their bass player or their drummer enough, you know, and pocketing most of the money. Yeah. Anything like that pisses me off, right?
Yeah. I agree. I think, you know, more transparency and more clarity, I think, you know, goes a long way. And at the end of the day, especially with what's happening in the world, I think that's got to be, you know, prominent on what's going on. So,
Well, one of our battles right now is Sync Lodge, and I've been doing this for the last two and a half years, is with companies like PRS for music in the UK, and getting them to share the data with us. And at first they're asking us to pay for it. I'm saying, there's no way we're going to pay for it, right? This is a benefit to your members. And then they start saying, well, it's our data and we're protective over it. I have to try to convince them it's not your data. It's the songwriter's data.
Yeah.
Right? It's their data. You're just using it to make sure that they're getting paid.
Yeah.
Right? And that kind of attitude, that kind of protective attitude, right, over things, I find it, this is something that, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me, and it just holds everybody back.
Yeah, it holds the process up. And I think with, you know, a lot of things that I've done and come through the industry, I used to think it was me or what have I done wrong or what is it?
Yeah.
And now I come to the point of, no, it's actually, I didn't do that wrong. It's because you're incompetent. It's because you're frightened to say yes. You can't say yes, because if you do say yes, you're going to get fired. And don't talk to me.
Or you're going to expose your vulnerabilities.
Yes.
You're going to expose how your system isn't really up to date, or you're going to expose this sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. And I think that is a lesson for a lot of people, of when you take it personally and you start questioning, second guessing yourself, right? It's always good to say, okay, maybe I should be better at this. Maybe I should read something. Maybe I should become more knowledgeable on these things, right? But it's not, most of the time it's just the other person that is, you know, you don't understand what's going on with them.
No.
Right?
And
maybe you've caught them on a bad day. They hang. I once had a promoter that yelled down the phone at me. It was the thing of, you know, this person's coming. It was like Daniel Lanois was coming to town.
Yeah.
And I found out the promoter, and I phoned him up, and I had never talked to him before. And this was after opening for Jethro Tull and all this. And I said,
Yeah.
Really like to open for Daniel Lanois. Right. Who are you? I said, oh, I'm Lionel. And you know, you can talk to this person or that person and they'll vouch for me. Right. You know, and the guy said, okay, well, look, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with opening. So, you know, I said, well, can I get back to you in a week? He said, oh yeah. Okay. Okay. Got back to him a week. He said, I still don't know. I said, well, can I get back to you in a week? He said, yeah. Okay. Okay. Third time, he yelled at me on the phone and he called me an asshole, right? What is wrong with you, you asshole? Why do you keep bugging me? No, you can't open up for, you know, the guy was having a bad day. He was having a bad month, right? Yeah. He was under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So I left it, right? Left it. That I went to the show myself, right? And I met up with Daniel afterwards and we got along and he invited me backstage and we were having whiskeys that he said Bono gave him the bottle of whiskey. I'm not sure if that's true or not. Why did he have in Vienna? But anyway, we're having a good talk, and the promoter comes in, and he says, Daniel, everybody's on the bus, everybody's ready to go when you are. And I heard the guy's voice, and I recognized his voice, right? And I said, oh, you're so-and-so. We talked on the phone. I'm Lionel, right? And the guy's face just dropped. Right. Oh my God. Right. Who the hell is this guy? He said they're drinking whiskey with my main client and they're laughing and carrying on. Right. So I said, you know, nice to put a face to the voice. Right. And I shook his hand. Right. I didn't say anything to Daniel Lanois. Right. It would have been so easy to badmouth the guy, but that's just not cool.
No.
Because that sort of thing would reflect more on me than on the guy. It would make me the asshole in the room.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Right? That's just not cool, right? So we were still talking. The promoter comes back upstairs saying, you know, 15, 20 minutes later, everybody's waiting. And Daniel says to the guy, look, it's my bus, right? They can wait. I'm having a drink with my friend here, right? Everybody can chill, right? The guy goes out. Right? We leave. Eventually, we leave. We go out on the street. He gives me a big hug, calls me brother. Right, say we'll meet again. Turns to the booking agent, shakes his hand, goes thanks, and gets on the bus. Right.
Yeah.
And the guy just slumped and walked away. And my one regret in that situation is I should have gone up to him and said, "Look, I want you to know I didn't say anything. I didn't tell about how you talked to him on the phone because I understand that you're under pressure, and I would never, you know, he doesn't know anything about that, so don't worry about that." Right. I should have said that to the guy. Because obviously he walked away thinking that I told, which doesn't make me look good, whether it's true or not. And also then the guy thought, okay, I can't deal with Daniel Lanois anymore. Maybe my career's over because, you know, I can't take the pressure. And I've always felt bad about that since then.
I can understand where you're coming from, and I can understand where the promoter's coming from, although I never would yell at people like that. But I think it is difficult, and I think hindsight's a great thing. But again, always someone in the room, line, or that someone will rear their head and say what they've done, and another person will say, oh, really? Do you know that person? Well, he's my next-door neighbour, and we do this. And that person
that's
talking noise will just crumble as if to say, I don't really know that person, and I'm making myself look a complete and utter idiot.
Yeah, and also bad-mouthing somebody else, the thought is, okay, so you're telling me bad things about this other person, so when we leave, what are you going to talk about me
exactly.
to somebody else?
Yeah, exactly.
You're an asshole, and I got to be protective over you, because if I open myself up, you might go and tell bad things to somebody else about me. That's, you know, honesty is always the best, right? And you know, admitting your mistakes is a very charming thing.
Being
the first to stand up and say, that's my mistake, own it.
Yeah.
Own it, right? And that makes you reliable. Everybody drops the ball sometimes, right?
Absolutely.
But own it, and that makes you a reliable, honest person, that you can trust that person then, because they didn't try to blame it on somebody else, right? Or they didn't tell you bullshit, right? They didn't try to make themselves look better by saying things that weren't true.
No, exactly. And I think, sort of touching on this, it's one of our last points, really, which is a shame. But with all of your experience of what you've done, do you get any spare time? And do you have any hobbies outside of the music industry?
Well, spare time, you know, I do like occasionally, I call it my dumbing down time, even though it's not all dumb stuff. And some of it's very smart stuff. But I do occasionally watch Netflix. And I get to a point where my brain just doesn't want to think anymore. It just wants to be entertained.
Yeah.
I do watch Netflix. You know, music for me is a big thing, right? I've got my own little studio, and I'll go down there sometimes and just play. I used to be doing shows with my band and writing and bringing new songs and that sort of thing, but there's no shows right now.
Right.
And then the other thing is I'm very fortunate to be with the woman I'm with. She's my best friend. And we have great, we like to cook together and we have great meals together and we make each other laugh. And you know, so I'm very, very fortunate that way.
Yeah, we don't get much time on this earth. And, you know, I think that's a good thing to do. And just, like you say, have a glass of wine, watch a bit of telly and have a chat.
Unplug sometimes. Right? Shut off. I also meditate. I meditate for about 20 minutes every morning.
Okay.
This is something I find, just stop the brain and just watch, just concentrate on the breathing. And it's funny how the brain will drift off, start thinking about things, and then you got to pull it back in just to watch the breathing.
Good yoga? Have you taken up yoga?
I've never have, but I was my parents in the 60s and early 70s were hippies, and there was a lot of yoga around. Maybe that's why I'm a bit, but I have taken on meditating, and there was a lot of that around then too.
Oh, wow.
But I've never tried, but I do exercise every day. You know, we got a cross trainer and we've got things like this, right? And I do exercise every day, and this is something.
That's funny. Like, it's funny you say that, because I played football a long, long time ago, and my emphasis now is I get up in the morning like yourself. I go out to the park for 7:30, and I train as if I was playing a game. And I've got that mentality of when I come back to the office, then I'm fresh and, you know, ready to go.
That's a great feeling.
To be honest with you, I'm. Been doing it for the last 4 or 5 years. I played professionally a long time ago and I haven't done anything, and I'm back now. But just agreeing with you, I just think it just makes you more alive, but got a lot more energy ready to do stuff. Yeah. So when I come in to do this and we've got editing to do, and Becky does a lot of yoga as well, so she's mentally very strong, and when we come away from it, we come away from it and then we come together to sort of, you know, put the shows together, and I think the energy's there because I think it just works.
Yeah. Well, that sort of thing, you know, it makes me happy. Exercising just seems to put me in a great mood, right? And then the team at Sync Lodge, you know, we have these developers, and I spend a good 3-4 hours a day dealing with them, and they always say, "You're always so happy, Lionel." There was one day last week where I was a little grumpy about something, right? We were dealing with something. And I said to him, "This is me being pissed off, just so you know." Right? They all laughed, right?
But no, I think, and also as well, you live in probably one of the most picturesque countries in the world.
Yeah, it's beautiful here. Vienna is a beautiful city. And we're actually right on the outskirts of it. So our backyard, we can see the hills.
Oh, nice. Nice. How long have you lived in Vienna? How long have you been there?
I first came here in 1997, the end of 1997.
Okay.
Came here. I thought I'd be here for 6 weeks or 2 months, and I was going to go up to Berlin and Hamburg and Scandinavia and end up in Paris, where I have cousins with quite a large apartment in Paris.
Yeah.
And that's what I was going to do. And I did travel around from Vienna, but I stayed here for the first time for 10 years. And after 6 years, I met my wife. We got married. And we got married 4 years after we met, and then we moved back to Canada for 7 years, and then moved back here in 2014.
Nice. Yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah. Now, it's a wonderful city. Everybody in their lifetime should come to Vienna and see it, but not now.
Not at the moment, no.
Everything's closed.
Definitely a place I want to go to. I've not been to Austria. So.
Well, you let me know. You let me know if you when all this opens up again, when you have time and the inclination.
Oh, definitely. I'll bring Bex over. You have to meet Bex. And
I like being a bit of a tour guide, and I like to also put together, if you tell me what type of entertainment you prefer.
Yeah.
Because Vienna has everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What type of food, what type of entertainment, and I'll find out what's going on.
Well, funny enough, just on a side bit, I played football last year in Denmark, and the first time I played in Denmark, and it was like a completely organised thing, and it was really, really good. It was like the former Danish team playing against an English team, and it was all part of their fitness. But the food, Lionel, in Denmark, to be honest with you, today, still some of the best food I've ever tasted. It was really fresh and just normal food, but it was just really...
Yeah.
Their salads were so colourful and just popping out at you. I had to eat
everything. Austria is the same.
Brilliant.
Austria's the same, you know. A lot of it's just there's a lot of local,
fresh.
You know, most of the meats, fresh, local, right? Most of the meats and the fruits and the vegetables, you know. There's obviously things that don't come from Austria,
sure,
like mangoes and things like that. But most of it in the supermarkets and the meats and all that, it's local and fresh. And there's a lot of bio, organic.
Yeah. Well, we can't argue with that, really. I mean, I'd love to talk to you all day, but Unfortunately,
another time.
Unfortunately, we come to our last point, and really, where can listeners connect with you? Online, website, social media? Where's the best place they can get hold of you?
You can easily find me on LinkedIn. Here's the funny thing.
Go on.
My name is Lionel Lodge, and I haven't found another one.
Have you not?
No. Facebook, LinkedIn, high school, anywhere.
Nothing.
I haven't found another Lionel Lodge, no. The last Lionel Lodge died in 1936, as far as I could find.
Okay.
So you can find me on LinkedIn,
yep.
Right? And you can find me on Facebook, and or my email for you know, go on Sync Lodge,
yep.
And at the bottom of the page there is an info thing to connect that will come to me.
Okay.
Right, and you can ask me any questions. Right, that's the easiest way.
Fantastic. Well, fantastic.
But I'm always open, and I always enjoy meeting new people. So it's and usually I reply within quite quickly.
Yep.
But if I'm busy and it takes me a bit of time, you know, maybe a few days, and it's nothing personal.
No, absolutely. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you today on the Entertainment Engine podcast line, and I really appreciate time, and thank you for being a guest.
Thank you very much, Pete. It's been a real pleasure for me too.
It was very cool to catch up with Lionel and discuss all about his experiences in the music business, from touring, label, and publishing. Some great info for any aspiring bands, musicians, and artists looking to build a career in the music industry. And now it's over to Bex for the question of the day.
Let's have a quick recap onto last week's question. What links Bob Marley, Bruce Springsteen, Amy Winehouse, and Michael Bublé? And the answer is... none of them have ever had a UK number one single, which I'm sure a lot of people out there will find hard to believe. I know I did. Big thanks to everyone who joined in this week and sent in their answers to us. We pulled one name out of a hat, and here's a big shout out to Scott from Portsmouth in the UK who got the answer right. I'll be back to you next week with more fun facts and a question of the day.
Well, that's all for today's episode of The Entertainment Engine, and thanks for listening.
Join us again next week when we discuss how artists and bands can navigate the music industry during the pandemic, sharing some really interesting advice to help move your career forward.
Plus, we will have our question of the day and music and movie facts for our listeners.
It would be great to have your feedback on the show, so you can always drop us a message at any time. We would love to hear from you.
So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platforms so you never miss an episode.
Thanks for listening to the show, and remember to all stay safe.
The Entertainment Engine.
Do not become attached to the signal, for the signal belongs to no one. 3 days from now, you will have an important revelation. Knowing this, there is something I need you to do for me.